Is today's retirement system up for the challenges of not only today, but tomorrow? Today, we'll be taking a step back and looking at that bigger picture context that your retirement will take place in. I'm Joe Casey, and this is the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. And my guest today is someone whose work I've followed closely for many years, Teresa Ghilarducci. She's the author of the new book, Work, Retire, Repeat: The Uncertainty of Retirement in the New Economy. A labor economist and nationally recognized expert in retirement security, she is the Bernard L. and Irene Schwartz Professor of Economics at the New School for Social Research and the director of the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis and the New School's Retirement Equity Lab. As a labor economist, she has spent her career working to ensure retirement security for all American workers. She joined the New School for Social Research as a professor of economics in 2008 after teaching at Notre Dame for 25 years. She frequently testifies before the U.S. Congress and serves as a media source to popular online news outlets about pensions, labor economics, and older workers. She also frequently publishes in economics journals and edited volumes and has authored several books, including How to Retire with Enough Money and How to Know What Enough Is, and Rescuing Retirement, which she co-authored with Tony James, who was executive vice chairman of the Blackstone Group at the time. And in an unusual partnership, they outlined their bold policy vision to create guaranteed retirement accounts for all American workers. Thanks so much for joining us, Teresa.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. I'm so happy to be on this program. I've listened to you for years.
And I've followed your work for the same amount of time. And you're focused on retirement throughout your career as a labor economist. What sparked your interest in retirement?
Yeah, well, I was a student of economics at Berkeley. I got my BA there. I got my PhD there. But since I was there for those 8 years, I got involved with a community. And one of the communities I got involved with for one of my jobs was the labor community. And they asked me as an economist to come in and help them prepare their negotiations. And I was pretty shocked. Like I was like 20, you know, 19 and 20, that they didn't just want wages. You know, I thought I was going to do a lot of wage research, but they really wanted to know how to prepare for their economic security their whole life. And these were people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who could really see that they would not be employable forever. You know, that the computer was coming on board, that the employer was figuring out ways to make their job harder, and that they really had to have something to look forward to. So I really saw that like retirement security was actually integral to a worker's life. So it wasn't like work and then retirement. Work was about retirement planning. And also one of those unions that I worked with happened to be my mother's own union. It was the Newspaper Guild of Northern California. And so I didn't think anything of it. Didn't everybody like help their mother bargain their pension? But no. And so early on, I was actually helping negotiate my own family's economic security. That is wild. I never really thought about it that way, but it's kind of remarkable.
Great story. But what would you say are the building blocks of a good retirement?
Well, me and everyone else in this field knows that the building blocks of a good retirement looks like not pillars, but is a pyramid. That there's a base, and then there's a middle part, and then there's a tippy top part. I think of it as the food pyramid because I'm kind of food oriented anyway. But you know, the base is your fruits, your vegetables, and your grains. That's a foundation. And that's Social Security. And that is it doesn't provide all of your retirement income needs for sure, but it's certainly a foundation. It's a foundation of security. Because retirement is for the lucky ones. A lot of people have missteps along the way that they have to take care of somebody and drop out of the labor force. So your family needs to be secured for that. So a spousal benefit is there, or you may be disabled, of course. In fact, a huge percentage of people can't do their jobs mentally and physically starting around 50. And so official disability may not be in the offing, but kind of a partial disability is something that we all are at risk of having to manage. And so Social Security has to take into account the insurance system a couple of missed quarters. We need social insurance against like wild recessions, you know, where you might miss hours in work. And so you need that foundation. And of course, you need the security longevity insurance that you will outlive, you know, any kind of money you might accumulate. You do need insurance for your longevity. So the base is Social Security. The other part is what you and your employer or your work-life situation devises, because saving on your own and putting that money in the market means that you don't have to sacrifice so much current consumption in order to prepare for the time that you can't work if you start early. If at 30, if you start, you only have to sacrifice 5 to 7% of your current consumption. And then the market, the investment returns take care of the rest. If you start at 50, you have to sacrifice half of your current consumption, and the market will only, you know, make up for 30%. So you need to have a component of savings, but it has to be in a structure where you save consistently through your whole work life. It can't be just, oh, I think I'll put $5 in my Vanguard or my IRA account. And when you have a workplace pension plan, it's usually pre-tax. And so all of a sudden, the government is one of your financial partners, and you put it into the market. So the market is your financial partner. Your employer might throw in some amount. So your employer becomes your financial partner. And then you, of course, are also contributing. So a workplace plan and the right structure gives you three other financial partners, and then your after-tax rate of return goes way up. So you need to have that workplace plan. And then on top of that is that little tippy top, that little triangle of a pyramid, which is where I put my whiskey and my beer and my ice cream. That's the filigree that you put on your own. If you want to save a lot and for your cabin in the woods or whatever extra you want. But so the structure of a good pension system has accumulation from three parts: your own, the employer, and then from Social Security. A good system also has three other designs: that you can accumulate, that you invest the money well, and that you deaccumulate it in a way that works for humans, which is that it's secure and it lasts your entire lifetime. So the structure of accumulation has to be in that pyramid structure, and then the whole structure has to have that accumulation work well with investment, work well with deaccumulation.
People fear a lot about retirement. And that surprised me when I first started doing this work. I'm sure it won't surprise you.
Yeah.
There are fears both financially and non-financially. What should people be concerned about?
Yeah, I love your podcast, especially, Joe, because you talk about that other part of the human experience about retirement. And so I really encounter that a lot in my book, which I thought would just be centered on the realities of the labor market and the realities of the finance market, that people fear things in a non-irrational manner, meaning, instead of the double negative, a rational manner. People should fear being pushed out of the labor market too soon. That risk is much higher than I even thought it was when I first started my work. Half of people ages between 51 and 62 have continuous employment, and not insignificant part of them do not stay with their same employer. Many of them, if they do move jobs, move to a job that pay less. Many of them, meaning people in our 50s, people in the 50s, don't get big raises in their 50s. So in contrast to the spreadsheet that you were supposed to start in your 30s that showed that you have an employment life that always has a raise, you get inflation plus one every single year, and you're employed every single year. And if you follow the advice of the financial planners, you save your raise every year. And when you're 50, you do what the tax code tells you to do and catch up a little bit by saving more. If you follow that plan and think that's the way your life is going to go, you are going to miss some of the biggest risks in preparing for retirement. You are going to miss the couple of recessions that happen along the way. You're going to miss that divorce that was probably healthy for you, but still is a setback. You're going to miss your child's needs. You're going to miss that you have been, your skills are obsolete, or ageism hits your job, or your own health or the health of your spouse is such that you have to leave early. So the biggest fear, the rational fear, is that you won't be able to accumulate enough by the time that your work life becomes dicey. And according to my data, Joe, those fears that you won't accumulate enough when you need it is right. Because most Americans, about 90% of Americans, have not accumulated enough for their retirement by the time they hit the time that they're retired.
And so many people are forced to retire, as you mentioned, far earlier than they planned.
The majority. That's one of my kind of my takeaways from my book, which is that most people think that retire is a verb that gives them agency. Because the whole verb says retire, and it sounds like it's a thing that you decide to do or not do. But in fact, the reality is that you are retired. The action is from the employer or the market, and it's visited upon you. And so I was very surprised, and almost linguistically, that I couldn't use the word retire with all of its implications because it was just inaccurate. So that was a big surprise. And the other big surprise is how many people reach the age of 62 and are retired, but have not maintained their standard of living while they're retired, won't be able to, and also have been middle-class workers, but have retired into basically de facto poverty. I think so much of that downward mobility is hidden and it's filled with shame. This is sort of your territory and your other podcasts. That in America, given that we've had this do-it-yourself system of like saving in your 401k or IRA or figuring out how to stay employed, you know, for 45 years, that was all on the individual. That if it doesn't work out, the corollary to do-it-yourself is embarrassment and shame. Like, oh, it didn't work out. Well, it must be your fault. Other people in other countries do not have that baggage when they come to retirement in need. But that's kind of a legacy and a thing, an unintended consequence of our do-it-yourself experiment we've had for 40 years.
You mentioned other countries, and I once heard you say, you can tell a lot about a society by how it treats its elders.
Yeah.
How does the U.S. compare to other countries in that regard?
In our country, there's no such thing as elders. You're supposed to stay young forever. That is just not the reality or the culture, the legitimacy of elders in other countries. In other countries, they tend to recognize people grow old and that people want to have a time in their life that they can control the pace of their time and the content of their time. And that somehow having that time at the end of your working life means that you're still a full human being and that you're actually deserving of that time. In the United States, it's not clear that if you're working, you can actually speak up for yourself as a human being. It's not clear that you can have an identity outside of a work life or be able to protect your time outside of your work or protect or find meaning or flow or identity or have the emotional content that you get from other people outside of the workplace. And so there's this idea, and it's embodied in the journalism that tells us a heroic story of, this is in my book too, I start with, of the heroic barista, McDonald's worker at 95, Amy Prinz, I remember her name. And this journalist said, God, isn't this wonderful that she's wiping tables at 90? And she is asked, she's asked, do you like your job? She says, yes, I like my job. Well, I know as a labor economist, people say one thing, but if you give them any out at all, they leave that wonderful job in a New York minute. So you ask people, do you like your jobs? And everyone says, well, sure, of course. And then you say, will you go to another job for one penny more? Just I'll go to another job like with one penny less. You just give me an option. The other way that we have a misperceived retirement is in this kind of working longer culture or this working longer consensus that everybody agrees that working longer is just great for society and great for the human being. And what I found in my book is that idea came from America, and the assumptions that predicate working longer is better for everybody just isn't true. Working longer for most people actually hastens death and illness because of the kinds of jobs most people have. And also adding more and more older people to the workforce who are desperate to work doesn't actually aid in productivity, which is actually the wealth of the nation, is how productive their workers are. It might help some employers who have this desperate supply of older workers, but collectively, working longer is not a good thing. I'm not saying have mandatory retirement, but in other countries that have mandatory retirement, they actually have pretty good pensions and the retirees have identity and stature.
And it depends on the type of job, as you mentioned the book too, because you make the point that physically demanding jobs are a whole different story.
Yeah, and also more, and people think that physically demanding jobs are on the wane because computers and machines have helped take the toil out of work. I just have to say that these machines and computers have redefined toil because I have a couple of students doing research on this, is that the computer has aided in surveillance. And surveilled jobs are hard and tedious in their own ways. A surveilled worker has more cortisol levels and have less control and agency. And that adds a toll to a body on the insides rather than on the biceps or on the back. And so maybe back-breaking work has waned, but the bending and stooping that comes out of a warehouse, or the kind of cortisol work that comes from having speed up and stress, has not diminished.
So as you mentioned, there are a lot of downsides to working longer. It's not a panacea.
Yeah. The downsides of working longer, it actually takes a toll on the whole workforce and on younger workers. So if you have 10 million baby boomers not having enough to retire on, desperate to work, they will come into jobs with lower wages. Also, if they can collect Social Security early, their wage demands are automatically mitigated because they're getting subsidies from Social Security system. So that may not take away a job from a younger worker, but it does limit the worker bargaining power if there are many other people willing to do the job and taking lower wages for. So working longer doesn't help the younger worker. Working longer doesn't help the economy because an older worker may actually have less productivity. That added worker does not bring up the average productivity. It may actually bring it down. And so you might have more stuff, but you're using more human labor to get that stuff, and that's not efficient. And it definitely does not help the older worker, who at older ages are particularly susceptible to the increase in the cortisol levels that being surveilled or being a subordinate position brings. Also, the jobs that older workers in America are taking are literally backbreaking. Care work and janitorial services disproportionately hire older workers. And these are jobs that the computer or a forklift hasn't really helped. These are jobs that do hasten morbidity and therefore death. It's one chapter, which is my book only has like 10 short chapters. I think they're pretty well written. It's only one chapter, but it didn't take 1/10 of the work. It took like 40% of the work. Because new research on what jobs do to older bodies was coming out on like almost every 5 minutes while I was writing the book last year. So it was really hard to keep up with it. And it's pretty definitive that people without a college degree who keep on working do die sooner. That probably adds to the inequality of longevity of lifespan, is actually not having good pensions and having to make people work longer.
And you mentioned pensions. The introduction of the 401k was a big event.
Yeah.
As a professor, what grade would you give the 401k?
Yeah, I was always suspicious of that student. You know, that 401k student came into my class about 40 years ago. And it requires employees to pick the right amount to save for their retirement. It requires employees to decide where to invest it for the highest risk and fee-adjusted rate of return. It required the worker to keep on saving at a constant rate for 40 years in order to supplement Social Security and maintain their standard of living. And I knew that workers would not be a match for the institutions that came along with it. first of all, the employer would not help the worker by always having a 401k in place. Only half workers have an employer that have a 401k. So I thought the worker wouldn't have that structure for them. Also, the worker would be inundated by really bad self-interested financial advice that charged way high fees and would not be able to put together an efficient portfolio. And I knew that employers would not contribute steadily to the plan. And every time there's a recession, every employer stops the contribution. My own employer in the COVID recession stopped contributing to my pension plan. My own employer, I thought, oh God, I'm now a victim. It was easier to look at how bad the system was from the outside because I had a plan. And now I'm getting hammered by it. I have a PhD in economics from Berkeley. I know my portfolio was not optimal. And then I'm going to panic like everybody else, wondering if it will last my lifetime. I don't know how to deaccumulate it. So it was a poor student when it started. And the grade I give it after 40 years of its work is a C minus and an F for the people who needed a good pension plan the most. So yes, it works for some, but it works for the highest income workers who got the biggest tax subsidy from the employer, or the high income worker who had an employer that always contributed and who paid high wages. It works well for that small group, A for that group, but for society, a C minus to an F.
And your new book is all about a better way. And in your new book, Work, Retire, Repeat, you lay out a proposal for a better system. Tell us about the Gray New Deal.
Yeah, so work is good. We all have to work. And maybe 35 years is what most of us, you know, are going to be productive at. Some of us might be productive for 40, 42 years. Not as many people as you would think can contribute. We're all productive in our own ways, but like for that market demand productivity, 40 years is kind of stretching it. Retiring is really good. The repeating part, I had to research who's repeating, who's going back to work. And it's usually desperate people. It's not bored people who find the golf course and being with their friends and family tedious. That's actually a tiny amount, even though they get a disproportionate amount of attention. So my book is about how we could have a really good, dignified off-ramp from work, which is good, to a time of life where you can control the pace and content of your time, which I think is a definition of what a human experience should be. Developmentally, Eric Erickson says that we go through these stages. I had that little book on human development on my desk throughout the whole time I wrote the book. Is that this what the good life is? Even Karl Marx says we have to sort of fish in the morning and do critical literary studies in the afternoon, you know, whatever, that we need to create our own life. And so retirement is the time that's well deserved, and we need to have a way to finance it. And so I call for a Gray New Deal. Gray, because I want to lift up the legitimacy and the dignity of like having gray hair, because everyone will have it. And I want to lift up the fact that we need something bold, like a New Deal. And it has to be one that respects work if people want it. Every adult who wants to work should be able to work and be free of age discrimination. So we need to lift up and protect the work that older people have, the age discrimination laws. We have to incent employers and not disincent employers to have older workers, like make Medicare a first payer. But we also have to fund pensions. So we have to put more money into Social Security by raising the payroll tax cap, that we have to have everybody who works pay for Social Security throughout the whole year. We cannot raise the retirement age because that's just a cut in benefits. And we need to have universal pensions. Everybody who has a Social Security account also needs to have a pension account. And there's a bill in Congress to do that.
Well, thanks for everything you're doing in this regard and for sharing your views. Best wishes on the book. A lot of great research in there and great points you're making.
Thank you. And the book is published by University of Chicago Press, and it's on Amazon as well, if anybody wants to read it.
And you'll see a link in the show notes to not only that book, but also two others that we highlighted, the one you wrote with Tony James of Blackstone.
Okay, great.
And also the How to Retire with Enough Money and What How Much Is
Enough. I like that book. And they're both short.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Teresa. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
It's time for the takeaway segment, a few actionable ideas to consider as you continue to plan for your retirement. Number one, how's your pyramid? I love this comparison to the food pyramid, where looking at the base of the pyramid, your fruits and vegetables are really two things, your financial security and your health and wellness. How are things in those two buckets, and what are the things you can do in the weeks and months ahead to bolster that part of your pyramid, that solid foundation? Moving up the pyramid, you have some of the things that we talk about often in this podcast, relationships, purpose, and meaning. What are you going to be retiring to? What are some of those activities that you haven't had time to pursue in your full-time working years that now you may have the freedom to do? And those might include service to others. They may also include creative pursuits. What is it for you? What's that next level of the pyramid? What's going to give you purpose and meaning and satisfaction in the years ahead? Number two, what will you do if things don't go exactly as planned? It's worth repeating that the majority of people retire earlier, they're forced to retire much earlier than planned. What if that happens to you? There's a lot of uncertainty out there, a lot of things that could happen, both personally and in the broader world. Corporate restructurings, economic shocks, health shocks, family situations, other things that could lead you to have to alter your plan. Factor that into your spreadsheets, your planning, your thoughts about your retirement life. What will you do if it doesn't go according to the plan you've carefully crafted? Number three, what should the future retirement system be like in the U.S.? This is not a political podcast in any way, but I think Work, Retire, Repeat offers a wealth of facts, data, analysis, and insights, as well as some provocative proposals about the future of the retirement system. And you've got to really see through the noise, and there's a lot of chatter, a lot of competing proposals, a lot of headline grabbers out there about retirement these days in a political context and a presidential election year. But what are the facts, and what's your vision of the future? This is a great resource to get grounded in some deep research. Thanks for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can glance and browse all of our episodes at our website, retirementwisdom.com, across 7 seasons. You'll also find there some recommended books on retirement. If you'd like to do your homework, many of them may surprise you because they're not specifically about retirement, but they can arm you with some new ideas and valuable principles and frameworks that can help you create the life you want in the years ahead.